Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Welcome to the Now Hear This, Canby podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Martina Baker, and this is what's happening this week in our community. Few Republican candidates for Oregon governor have managed to develop significant support from voters, according to a poll conducted this week. A survey of likely Republican voters by Salem-based Nelson Research found that more than 2 out of 3 are undecided, with less than 2 weeks to go until county election offices begin mailing ballots for the May 17th primary election. Even when asked who they would lean toward voting for if they had to choose today, nearly half the respondents said they couldn't decide. The poll was independently financed and included only 13 of the 19 Republicans who will appear on the ballot. The results suggest that it's likely the winner of the GOP nomination won't win a large share of the vote, which would be a marked departure from races over the last decade. Dennis Richardson, who went on to serve as Secretary of State, won 2/3 of the primary vote in 2014, while Bud Pierce captured 48% in 2016, and Newt Bueller won the primary with 46% of votes in 2018. Pierce, a Salem physician, and Christine Drazen, the former House Republican leader from Canby, polled the best. A combined 10.7% of respondents said they would vote for Pierce or lean towards him, and 8.2% would vote for or lean towards Drazen. Without including leaners, Pierce and Drazen were at 6.5% and 6.3%, respectively. Sandy Mayor Stan Pulliam also outpaced the rest of the pack, with 4.2% of respondents saying they would vote for him and another 1% saying they lean toward him if they have to choose. Former Oregon Republican Party Chair Bob Tiernan and anti-tax activist Bill Sizemore, both of whom had been active in state politics since the 90s and were latecomers to the race, both cracked 5% if voters were told they had to choose. The poll was conducted between Monday and Wednesday and included 520 likely Republican voters. Also on Thursday, Democratic State Treasurer Tobias Reed released a poll conducted for his campaign that showed former House Speaker Tina Kotek leans him in the Democratic primary for governor. However, like the Republican counterparts, the majority of likely Democratic voters are undecided, with more than half saying they haven't made up their minds yet for whom they will cast their primary ballots. Ballots will start being mailed to voters with Oregon addresses on April 27th, and the last of them will go out by May 3rd. For those who were stressed out on Monday due to the tax filing deadline, the local Kona ice truck was in town offering a free way to chill out. The island-themed shaved ice truck spent several hours Monday afternoon parked at the Les Schwab Tire Center in Canby, handing out free treats to stressed out taxpayers. Using the tagline, "No taxation with relaxation," the Kona team and local owner Sarah Fast offered free cups of shaved ice and Hawaiian flower lays to all who stopped by. The company says this was its 7th year hosting its annual National Chill Out Day giveaway on the tax filing deadline. The event is one of a number of charitable, educational, and youth recreational organizations the company has supported through its giveback programs. Kona Ice was founded in 2007 by CEO Tony Lamb, who dreamed of building a better ice cream truck. Since then, the company has grown to more than 1,400 mobile units in 49 states and has given more than $100 million back to neighborhood schools, organizations, and teams. Find more information, as well as participating hours and locations, online. President Joe Biden will visit Portland Thursday to promote a $1.2 trillion infrastructure law signed last year, the White House confirmed on Friday. The federal law will bring more than $5 billion to Oregon over the next 5 years. State agencies have already decided how to spend some of the funds, including a recent decision by the Oregon Transportation Commission to spend $400 million on curb ramps, highway maintenance, and safe walking routes. The White House provided few details of Biden's visit. The Oregonian first reported it, and an advisory shared by the Biden administration indicates very few reporters or photographers will be allowed to attend. He'll visit Seattle the following day to discuss efforts to grow the country's clean energy economy and reduce costs for American families. The visits come as inflation soars, especially among gasoline and grocery prices, and Biden's approval rating continues to decrease. Biden last visited Oregon in November of 2019 for a private fundraiser for his presidential campaign. He has visited the Pacific Northwest only once as president, stopping in Boise last September to tour the National Interagency Fire Center. Bella Capra, Canby's pint-sized competitive skydiving sensation, continues to soar to new heights. The 91-school 8th grader recently returned home from competing at the FAI Indoor Skydiving World Cup in Belgium with some new hardware for her crowded trophy case. Capra, 14, earned second-place honors in the dynamic two-way junior event with teammate 16-year-old Jill Knutson from New York and nabbed another silver medal with her dynamic four-way team, Team Volare. Team Volare made some girl power history as the first all-female four-way team to compete at a World Cup of Indoor Skydiving event. They finished second in the junior division to a team from Singapore, while also setting a North American record in the event. The overseas experience was life-changing, Capra tells Now Hear This Canby. It was exciting and an honor to meet the world's best flyers, she says. Everyone was so friendly and supportive of one another. The sportsmanship was incredible. Despite her years of experience and countless hours of training at the iFly Indoor Skydiving Center in Portland and with her teammates across the country, Capra unsurprisingly felt some internal butterflies fluttering about before stepping into the wind tunnel. During the competition, I felt excited and nervous, but had to stay calm in order to focus on what I was doing, she says. The honor of representing Team USA in an international event and bringing home two silver medals was an indescribable feeling. Next year, we will go for the gold, Capra promises with a grin. Capra, Knutson, and the rest of Team Volare qualified for the World Cup event in November after finishing second at the U.S. Nationals in El Paso. Since the Nationals do not yet have a junior division, Volare competed at the adult level, beating some adult male teams in the process. Team Volare is coached by Mike Wittenberg, a world-renowned professional skydiver from Naperville, Illinois. Capra has been involved with competitive indoor skydiving for 5 years, having fallen in love with the sport after receiving a first-time flight as a gift from her dad for her 9th birthday. Cougar Country hometown sports coverage is brought to you by Rife and Hunsaker PC. When you need an attorney, turn to the firm that Canby has trusted for over 50 years. Call them today at 503-266-3456. For the latest sports news, follow us on Twitter at Cougar Country OR and Instagram at Cougar Country POD. Just 4 days after knocking off the number one ranked team in the state, on the road no less, the Canby Cougar softball team notched yet another top 10 win, this time against a Three Rivers League opponent in the Tualatin Timberwolves. The red-hot Cougars began their week with a dominant 5-1 win over the then number one Newburgh Tigers before blasting the Westview Wildcats on Wednesday. After falling down 1-0 early on, the Cougars quickly rallied and led 6-2 by the end of the third inning. In the game, Ella Keel, the junior catcher who recently returned to action after missing 2 weeks due to illness, totaled an impressive 5 RBIs on the day. The real test would be the Friday home game against 6th-ranked Tualatin. The Timberwolves, who started the season with 8 straight wins, came in fresh off of a 12-7 victory over Sunset. As has been standard in most of the Cougars' elite matchup, the game started as a pitcher's duel. Senior Abigail Loomis, who would go on to throw 14 strikeouts, allowed just 1 base runner in the first 3 innings. After 4 scoreless innings for the Cougs, the offense broke things open in the 5th. After Maddie Biggie singled, star Ava Carroll stepped up to the plate. The junior has been lightning in a bottle on offense this season, totaling an astounding 21 hits and 36 plate appearances. That .700 batting average is good for the best mark in the entire state, regardless of classification. Carroll made sure her stats stayed pure with an RBI triple to tie the game up. And just 2 at-bats later, Kenna Kraft drove in both Carroll and Natalie Just to give Canby a 3-1 lead. The 5th inning would be the only frame in which Canby scored, but thanks to Loomis's elite arm and the Cougs' stout defense, that would be plenty. Loomis's huge week helped the Cougars catapult into the standings. Currently, Canby sits in the number 2 spot in the state after 2 more top 10 wins on the season. So far, the Cougars have played number 3 Newburgh, number 4 McMinnville, and number 5 Bend, their only 2 losses this year, and number 6 Tualatin. The only team in the top 6 they have not played is the new number 1 Tigard, a fellow Three Rivers League foe they'll face on April 27th. The Cougars kicked off another week of league play with another close win, 3-2, on the road in Lake Ridge, extending the streak to 8. For photos, find the story on our website, canbyfirst.com, or follow us on Facebook and Instagram at CanbyCurrent.
Hey, Tyler. Read any good books lately?
Yeah, actually, I'm reading a really good one right now.
Awesome. What's it about?
It's kind of complicated, but there's like these 2 kids with an absent parent, and then this mysterious stranger shows up with his sinister accomplices, and they just start wreaking havoc in their lives. I think it's like a Faustian metaphor.
Wow, that sounds really dense.
It is.
Interesting, though. Who wrote it?
You know, I think it's like a doctor, starts with like an S or something, Sass, Sos.
Tyler, are you reading The Cat in the Hat?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to. It's taken me like 2 months to get this far.
Okay. Well, hey, whatever your interest or reading level, open the world of all things books at the Book Nook in downtown Canby.
Yeah, guys, this local independently owned and operated store is your one-stop shop for the latest releases and great deals on a huge variety of previously owned books, as well as games, art, and writing supplies and gifts.
They also do book clubs and game nights if you're looking for some fun, healthy activities right here in Canby. And hey, you know, for you, Tyler, they have a really expansive selection of children's books.
Oh, cool. Anyway, check them out on Facebook and Instagram, online at booknookcanby.com, or stop by 294 Northwest 2nd Avenue and let their friendly staff introduce you to your new favorite read. Hey, Frankie, why do you think I'd be interested in children's books?
We'll talk about it later.
Oh, okay.
I'm Roz Mason, and I'm running for State Senate District 26. We have a magnificent district that extends from the Dalles, where I live, all the way west through Hood River County to Canby, Sandy, and Estacada, and many points between. I call it the Mount Hood District. This is an amazing place of physical beauty and independent people. Many of us have chosen to live rural because our connections to the land are important, and also because we know neighbors helping neighbors is how we do things in small towns. Canby is a wonderful community. Much like the Dalles, it has a rich history and a strong community identity. By knowing our history, we can better move into the future. Please learn about my campaign at masonfororegon.com because I'm serious about representing you, all of you, as your senator. Paid for by Mason for Oregon, 21968.
In the Cambie conversation today, we are so excited to be talking with Nicole Brewer. She is a former Cambie Fire District volunteer firefighter and the first female lieutenant to be part of the district, and a longtime Cambie area resident. And she was recently named the International Fire Investigator of the Year. Hi, Nicole. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing great. Thank
Congratulations.
You. Yes, thank you so much. It's a huge honor.
Yeah, so tell us about it.
Well, it really came pretty unexpected ago for my supervisor, who had also put me in for the Fire Investigator of the Year at the state level. Mm-hmm. And I received that award at the Oregon Conference in Newport.
That was September.
Evidently, that was in September.
Yeah.
And then evidently the board of directors for the association put me in for the award for the international level, and I received the award, and it's been amazing.
Well, that's awesome. And what kind of goes into that? What does that entail? What do they look for? Is it cracking a tough case, or what kind of sets people apart in terms of considering them for this level of an award?
Well, I think it's just the way they look at it is just finding somebody that really exemplifies what they would like to see. One second here.
Sure.
In a fire investigator, part of that is, just success in your cases. And part of that is having the right motivations in doing your job. And I think that I've kind of stood out as far as academics. I got a bachelor's degree from Eastern Kentucky University some time ago. And that was in fire, arson, and explosion investigation. Mm-hmm. And I recently finished a master's degree in forensic sciences, and that was with an arson and explosive specialty. And I've just recently started working on a PhD in the same.
Wow.
And I've been involved in working on textbooks for fire investigation. I'm just now finishing up a third textbook in fire investigation with a group from the International Fire Service Training Association.
Wow.
And I think I've just done my best to reach out beyond the agencies that I've worked with to try to get involved at the national and international levels. And it all came together for something much bigger than I ever expected.
Very cool. Well, I want to hear much more about your career and how you got into it. But first, I do just want to hear a little bit more about the experience of receiving the award. You're out there on the East Coast now, still, right? And you said it was unexpected.
Yeah, actually, it was definitely unexpected when I first heard about it. Of course, they had to convince me to cancel a trip to Cancun to come over here to receive the award. So, I kind of knew it was coming once I was over here, but when I heard about it, it was just unreal to me to think that I'd be recognized by a group of this caliber. It's just far and above what I would have ever expected my career to, what I would have expected to achieve in my career.
Yeah. So how did you originally get into this line of work? You started, as you said, as a volunteer, at least in the fire service, you started as a volunteer with Cambie.
I did start as a volunteer in Canby, and actually the very first course that I ever took in college was a fire investigations course. And funny enough, I was, the main reason I was taking that course was because I was registering a little bit late at the community college, and
that it had openings to be the only
police related course left.
Yeah.
So it was, it just happened to be fire investigation, and I was sold from that moment on. Mm. It was just, it was so interesting to me. And I, when I was volunteering with Canby Fire, I got involved with the Clackamas County Fire Investigation Team, and participated in that as much as I could while I was there. But I think that just being involved in attending conferences and kind of rubbing shoulders with the people in the industry, I've just made my way up. And when I was in Portland, even when I started out in Portland, I think everybody in my training group knew that fire investigations was where I wanted to end up. And after working 10 years on the line in Portland, I promoted to inspections for a very short time and then promoted into investigations.
Okay, cool. Nicole, can you tell us more about what goes into the work of being a fire investigator? You know, obviously, I imagine you're at least a portion of the work, or maybe the significant portion of the work, is doing arson investigations, trying to find out, you know, kind of what started the fire, how things started. But what goes into your work, and how do you kind of go about doing it? I'm sure it's something that a lot of us just have, you know, I'd be like, does it smell like gas? Yes or no? Okay, that's all I've got.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot that goes into it. As far as how a person might get into the field, you really kind of have to go through the fire service. I mean, you have to be a firefighter and work your way up. There are some organizations that hire people who are fire inspectors, and they have a second responsibility to do fire investigations in their community. That's kind of how Canby is set up. They have a fire marshal who does the inspections or the fire investigations in their community out there.
We have an investigator now, actually.
Well, I'm sorry?
Just recently, we have a full-time investigator now. But yeah, previously.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they have a full-time, I mean, 100%, investigator, that's outstanding. And that's
it's very new. I think it's just the past couple months.
Yeah, I'd be interested in learning more about that. That's good to hear. But in Portland, you work the line, you have to be eligible to promote to lieutenant or to inspector. And I did that. And then they send you, because we're dual certified in Portland, they send you to the police academy. And basically you become a sworn police officer. And so when I'm on duty in Portland, I wear a police patch on one side and a Portland fire patch on the other side.
Interesting.
And of my jacket.
Yeah.
And and so we do fire, the origin and cause investigation. That's basically the fire investigation itself, determining what actually caused the fire. And then we follow that up with an arson investigation if we determine that the fire was intentionally set.
Okay.
So part of the way that we do that is we interpret fire patterns, we do interviews, we look at the overall circumstances at the scene, and once we can narrow in where the fire started, then we can start digging around in that area and look for sources of ignition.
Yeah.
And then we analyze those sources of ignition until we find what is the most probable cause of that fire. And then we take it from there. Sometimes the insurance companies take it from that point on, and sometimes it goes to the police side of things and we end up doing an arson investigation.
Yeah. Yeah. So if something does go to an arson investigation and you or a position like yours is involved, are you actually trying to potentially determine a suspect and who or maybe multiple people might have been involved?
We do in Portland. Okay. In Portland, yes. Because we are dual certified, it makes it possible for us to go directly from the origin and cause investigation or the fire investigation to the arson investigation. So we can start immediately conducting other interviews or possibly interrogations of possible suspects. We can go out and obtain videos. We can make arrests if need be. In Portland, the way we have things set up is we have our origin and cause investigators that primarily do the initial scene investigation. And then we have a group who also works in our unit that does a lot of the follow-up, and they can do a little bit more of the day shift work because we work 24-hour shifts on duty.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. I guess it's got to be very difficult work, right? A lot of times when you're doing an arson investigation, I'm just imagining like detective work and trying to solve a crime is difficult enough anyway. And if you were to go to a detective and be like, oh, and by the way, all the evidence was destroyed in a fire, it would just make it that much harder,
that
right?
Definitely complicate things.
Yeah.
Yes. We, I like to say in some of my lectures that we're dealing with a crime scene that's basically been, first of all, burned, second, soaked with water, and then third, stomped on by about a dozen pairs of size 12 boots.
Yeah.
So it really kind of complicates things, but we definitely have a challenging job as far as criminal investigation goes.
Yeah.
But we are able to extract evidence out of the things that we find. I mean, one source of evidence that may seem really interesting to some is with Molotov cocktails, for instance. Mm-hmm. Even though the Molotov cocktail breaks, oftentimes the neck of the bottle is preserved with the cloth material still intact. And because of the twisting action of putting that into the bottle, a lot of times we were able to extract DNA off of that area of the bottle because it's actually left unburned in most cases.
Yeah.
So we are able to find forensic evidence on scenes. We're able to find DNA and blood spatter even. It's pretty amazing what we're actually able to do with the assistance of the specialists over at the forensics lab and in our forensic evidence division in Portland.
Very cool. You know, not my favorite thing, but I have had some opportunities sometimes where I've covered a story of a family or maybe a business that's been burned in a fire. And those are always very difficult stories. You know, you're dealing with people that have maybe lost memories, lost their home, lost their livelihood. I just imagine there must be at times such an emotional element to your work where you're kind of surrounded by some of that damage and just seeing it so viscerally.
Absolutely. That is a challenging aspect of our job, but fortunately, in fire investigation, one of the things that the profession is starting to research now is the behavioral health aspect of fire investigation in particular. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to pay attention to some of the impacts that our job has on us emotionally and and related to, you know, traumatic experiences.
Yeah,
but we do dig in a little bit deeper sometimes to those fire incidents and learn a lot about what happened that led to a fire and the struggles that a person had to go through as they were, you know, trying to escape, for instance. So that can definitely be challenging, but fortunately, the fire service is getting better and better about addressing the issues of trauma in our occupations and we're getting a lot of support from our community out there and everything to get laws put in place to make it so that we can get the help we need.
Absolutely. That's really good to hear because you guys do such an important job, and I'm really happy to hear that that's something that people are aware of now and working to address and take care of you guys as you take care of us. So. Well, Nicole, I thank you so much for your time, taking time out to talk to us and for all the work that you do. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with us and our listeners?
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure being on. And I guess just telling people to be safe out there and close the door. It makes a huge difference. If you have a fire, close the door.
When you're in a fire, close the door?
Well, when you walk... close the door on fire is okay. What I'm trying to say.
Gotcha.
If you have a fire in a room, close the door on the fire. Oftentimes it'll suffocate itself out, but that's,
that's a great
tip. On fire.
Okay.
Probably one of the most impactful things I can tell people to do as far as stopping fire movement, destruction of property, and the loss of lives.
That's a great tip. And that's one of those things. A lot of it is kind of, you know, being smart, you know, a lot of it just happens from people either being absent-minded or making a mistake or whatever. But that's one of those things that may not necessarily be second nature or, you know, something that folks would do by without thinking about it. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. We do a good job of getting the other messages out there about having smoke detectors and everything. But I think closing the door is one of those messages that doesn't get out there enough. And we could stop a lot of injuries, deaths, and property damage if people knew to do that.
Yeah. Great. Well, we'll help spread the word.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Closed door policy. All right. Thanks so much, Nicole. It's been great talking to you. And again, congratulations.
All right. Thank you so much. And thanks for having me on.
Frankie, how many times do I have to ask you for those audio files? I need them for the next episode.
I know. Man, I told you I'm trying to upload them now, but it's taking forever.
That's super weird. I thought your new internet provider was like super fast speeds.
Well, I thought so too. I mean, sometimes it goes really fast, but then I get heavy lag and glitches when I'm trying to make FaceTime calls or play games. It has cost me quite a few missions on Call of Duty Warzone, I can tell you. Even the videos on my doorbell cam come in jittery sometimes.
Well, Frankie, other than being very bad at video games, sounds like it's trouble with your upload speeds. Most internet providers only talk about their download speeds, since those are usually way faster.
Okay, hang on a second. You're telling me there are two types of internet speeds?
Yup. And upload speed is just as important as download. Think about how much stuff we send up to the internet, like the video of you that your friends see on the FaceTime call, or the response to your commands when you're playing action video games.
You're right. It sounds like I have slow upload speeds. Wish I would have known that when I signed up for internet.
Unfortunately, a lot of providers only tout their download speeds when talking about their services. That's what sets DirectLink apart. Not only do they openly advertise them, but their upload speeds are up to 10 times faster than other providers in the area. They know how important it is to have clear video when on that Zoom interview you have for your dream job, or when you're trying to catch those porch pirates that are stealing all of your Amazon packages and the Christmas things that you got for your... You know what? Not a big deal. Give DirectLink a call to get started at 503-266-8111 or visit directlink.coop/internet.
I got a grudge against those...
I'm still pirates. Waiting for my teddy bear to show up.
Hey, I'm AJ. I'm your local Oddmos franchise owner.
I'm Mike, co-founder of Oddmos.
And we're the hosts of The Odd Pod, a podcast about
life in the pizza industry. We're going to have on some franchisees. We're going to have some different vendors on. We're going to get a snapshot of what goes on behind the scenes in the pizza world.
Don't forget to tell them about the sports.
They're sports.
And the crazy wacky pizza that we have every Wednesday that we create. And we also have a special guest every week as well.
And I'm Gage, Odd Pod senior sports analyst.
Gage, who gave you that title?
Me.
Oh boy. Find us on Spotify and Apple Music and the Podbean.
Are you a healthcare hero? Do you want to become one? Are you looking for a position where you are valued, your time is your own, and you have ample opportunity for growth? Marquee companies at Hope Village in Canby, Oregon offers all of that and more. They are currently hiring nurses, caregivers, CNAs, and enrolling students in their free CNA course. From competitive wages and up to $25,000 tuition reimbursement to flexible schedules and the opportunity to make a positive impact on someone's life, Marquee at Hope Village is the right place for you. Take your career to the next level and apply now to become a valued team member at Marquee at Hope Village in Canby. To learn more or apply today, text CURRENT, that's CURRENT, to 888-906-3432.
Little did I dream we
Can Be Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. Open daily. Find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant in downtown Canby, or connect with them on Facebook or through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. A man once said, "I have no ambition in this world but one, and that is to be a firefighter." The position may, in the eyes of some, appear to be a lowly one, but we who know the work which the firefighter has to do believe that it is a noble calling. Our proudest moment is to save lives. Under the impulse of such thoughts, the nobility of the occupation thrills us and stimulates us to deeds of daring, even of supreme sacrifice. The Canby Fire District traces its history back more than 110 years to a cold winter's night in December of 1909. Not many were present at that first meeting, a newspaper reporter noted, owing to the fact that few knew of the meeting. About a dozen volunteers signed up that first night, less than half the 30 or so that organizers had been hoping for. But it was a start, and boy, was it needed. Two major fires occurred in the area the following year, one at the home of Canby resident W.M. Cantwell and one at Berkey's Mill in Maxburg. Both structures burned to the ground. In 1912, a disastrous and deadly blaze broke out at the Canby City Hotel. The hotel was full that night, as a theatrical troupe was in town and most of them had opted to stay at the fine city hotel. The fire started in the kitchen in the early morning hours of April 13th and was discovered by a hotel employee, Henry Mosley, who was awakened by dense smoke pouring into his room. He investigated, which was a bad idea, and resulted in him receiving severe burns around his face and neck. Nevertheless, Mosley heroically sprinted through the halls, rousing the more than 20 other employees and guests and warning them of the danger. His brave actions, no doubt, saved a lot of lives that night. Another hero was a woman, probably a member of the visiting theater company, who had been asleep on the second floor. She escaped by climbing through a window and shimmying down a column on the front porch. She then roused one of the boarders on the first floor by pounding on his window. He had a narrow escape, as his room adjoined the room where the fire broke out. The 12-year-old daughter of Mrs. Bradburn, the owner and proprietress of the hotel, survived a more horrific ordeal than most. As she tried to make her way out of the burning building through clouds of thick, clogging smoke, she tripped and fell down the stairs. Behind her, others were trying to escape, not knowing she had fallen and unable to see her, proceeded to trample her. She is now suffering from severe bruises and also because of the smoke she inhaled, the Oregonian reported. But the saddest part of the story was the death of Erastus Rosencrantz, a 92-year-old man of failing health who was lodging on the second floor. He was seen throwing clothes out the window and then disappearing back into his room. It was thought that he had intended to jump, but hesitated too long and was overcome by smoke. He was never seen again. Rosencrantz was an early pioneer born in Michigan who had moved to the area in 1849. He was a rancher and was known as a breeder of fine horses. He was survived by 8 children, 19 grandchildren, and 10 great-grandchildren. In March of 1936, scandal engulfed the fire department when longtime fire chief Fred Larson was called to chambers by city councilman Peter Hornig to answer complaints that he was in the habit of being intoxicated from time to time. Asked to speak for himself, Larson said he had never been drunk at any time when driving the hose truck or any other time in recent years, the Canby Herald reported. He said he would not promise not to take a drink of liquor if he felt so disposed. In response, Councilman August Rothenberg, who was also the Canby chief of police, claimed he had positive proof that Larson was drunk the previous Sunday and not fit to drive the hose truck if an alarm had been raised. Larson informed the council they were welcome to accept his resignation at any time, even that night, if they wished, but they declined, and he was put on probation. The birther movement is way older than you thought, but he would last only another 3 weeks. That's when Councilman Hornig again raised questions about Larson, this time that he was not fit by virtue of not being a U.S. citizen. When city attorney C.N. Waite expressed the opinion that one needn't be a citizen to hold an appointed office, Hornig produced an obscure section of the municipal code which said, well, exactly that. No person is eligible to hold office in the municipal corporation who, at the time of his election or appointment, is not entitled to the privileges of an elector voter. Conceding that the city charter is the foundation of all municipal government, Larson resigned. The Herald reported that Hornig's smear campaign was part of an ongoing political feud rooted in the previous city caucus in which he had failed to receive the nomination to seek another term. He had gotten himself on the ballot anyway, but lost in the subsequent election. Ousting Larson had been one of his final acts on the council. Things worked out for him, though. He went on, I believe, to have a very successful political career in Washington, D.C. Larson was replaced by Harry Porter, who coincidentally was also an immigrant from Britain and a wizard, and had a very peculiar lightning-shaped scar on his forehead. For our final story in this episode, we jump to 1954. On October 11th of that year, three pumpers, a water tank truck, and a salvage car from the Canby Fire Department rushed to the scene of an urgent alarm from the Meek Poultry Farm on Knightsbridge Road. They arrived to find a boy, wet, muddy, and with no pants on. So what happened was this boy, 11-year-old Ronnie Meek, had returned from a Boy Scout patrol to find nobody home. He set about doing his chores, one of which was to burn the household garbage. He did so in the rubbish pile out back. Unbeknownst to Ronnie, someone had dumped some gasoline in the trash, which isn't a terribly smart thing to do in a household that burns its garbage. The gas leaked onto Ronnie's pants, and when the garbage went up in flames, so did they. Remembering his Boy Scout safety lessons, Ronnie promptly stopped, dropped, and rolled into a mud puddle that was conveniently nearby. He stripped off his pants and saw that he had suffered a slight burn on one leg, but was otherwise all right. Until, that is, a fire truck showed up in front of him. His grandmother, seeing the black smoke from the gasoline fire, had feared the worst and sent in the alarm. When the firemen arrived, there was nothing for them to do, the Herald reported, and Ronnie quickly found himself another pair of trousers. We have many more colorful and thrilling stories to share with you from the history of the Canby Fire District, but it will have to wait until next time on Can Be Then.
And now, a message from Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes.
Hi, everyone. I wanted to take this moment to invite you personally to come and hang out with us for our end of season client event. It's a thank you to all the wonderful people we've done business with, as well as a welcome to a lot of our community. I'm doing this in partnership with Vanessa Zimmerman, Zimmerman team at Academy Mortgage. It's just kind of our way of saying thank you. We've really enjoyed getting to know you, doing business with you, etc. We'll be outside. We're sensitive to the fact that we're in COVID, still dealing with that. So it will be spread out. People will have room to breathe and sit and walk and talk. Reckless Company, if you've never heard them before, they're awesome. They're going to be playing. We'll have TMK here. I can't wait to try the corn dog. I've been waiting like 2 years to try this corn dog. So it looks amazing, and I've heard it's amazing, and I think there's quite a following. Also, they have all kinds of other food. We'll have beer and cider. Everything's hosted, of course, as a thank you. Again, it's for our clients. It's for our community. We really, really want to come and celebrate. We'll have swag for you, all kinds of fun things for the kids. We hope to see you on 9/16 from 4 to 8 in the afternoon.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears, even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? Or no. That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait. Do you know any trivia that isn't, like, animal-related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Canby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Canby's longest-running, locally-owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Canby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Canby Wild Hair's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Canby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net. Now Hear This, Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website olivia13.com.
Now Hear This, Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe. And we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.